This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. From time to time, an exhibition featuring the work of a contemporary artist or artists from a foreign land comes to museums and galleries in the United States. This presents challenges for all involved, but let's talk about the challenges for curators. How do they present the work so that we might be better able to see it within its cultural, historical, and political contexts? Think for a moment about the art of Japan and China over the last several decades. Japan, war, the atomic bomb, and American occupation. They're critical. China, war, and the Cultural Revolution leap to mind. And of course, these are gross simplifications, but in this portion of the program, we'll aim to take a more nuanced look at the work of curators in terms of how they frame contemporary East Asian art for American audiences. Do they work with the artists involved? How do they decide what to include and how to display it? Are there political ramifications? Two curators well-known in the art world are our guests this afternoon. They are art historians Britta Erickson and Alexandra Monroe. Let me tell you something about each of them. Britta Erickson's work focuses on contemporary Chinese art. Her shows include On the Edge, Contemporary Chinese Artists Encounter the West, opening today at the Davis Museum at Wellesley College. It will travel to the Indianapolis Museum of Art in July. An independent curator, she has taught at Stanford University and the University of California, Berkeley. Alexandra Monroe is the former director of the Japan Society Gallery in New York City. She is the newly appointed and first senior curator of Asian art at the Guggenheim Museum in New York City, and she is planning an exhibition there titled Contemplating the East, Asian Ideas and Modern American Art. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments for our guests. Join us with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Use that number if you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area. Alexandra Monroe and Britta Erickson will be in Champaign-Urbana later this week to participate in the symposium Making a Scene, Contemporary East Asian Art in the U.S. For more information, you may contact the Center for East Asian and Pacific Studies at the University of Illinois or the Krannert Art Museum. Our thanks today for help with this program to the U of I's Ann Berkus Chasson, assistant professor in the School of Art and Design. Again, the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Alexandra, Britta, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. When we hear the words Asian art, I suspect many of us think of the art of the old masters, paintings and prints of landscapes and tea ceremonies, sculpted jade, masks and screens. And apparently this was true of the Western art world, too, until fairly recently. Attention to contemporary East Asian art began in earnest just maybe a decade and a half ago. A question for each of you. How did you become aware that contemporary Asian artists were doing work that demanded attention, that was worth taking a look at? Let's begin with Alexandra.
It's a very good question. Ironically, my interest and research began in New York City, where I moved after 10 years of high school and college in Japan, where I had, as an undergraduate at Sophia University, very much focused on, as you just mentioned, the traditional arts of East Asia. And what I came to realize very quickly is not only is New York the third capital of Japan, Tokyo, Kyoto, New York, by virtue of it receiving so many artists and architects and designers and just sort of the great creative minds of Japan were regularly coming through New York, But more importantly, many of the post-war Japanese artists, the post-war Japanese avant-garde artists, had settled in New York from the late 1950s and early 60s and formed a virtual sort of avant-garde in exile. And I first became aware of their work at an exhibition at Japan Society that I worked on, an exhibition of the artist Ushio Shinohara. And in the course of researching the presentation of this artist who lived downtown in Chinatown, whose work is known for these sort of giant sculptures made of bubblegum wrappers and jelly beans of sort of geisha riding motorcycles, comic book figures from both Japan and America intertwined in this fantastic display of sort of comic havoc. I realized that this artist was the founding member of a very important avant-garde group in Japan, the Neo-Dada organizers, in the late 1950s and early 60s, and his story had never been told. And upon further research, I realized the history even within Japan was sort of based on local myth. There was very little concerted, developed, scholarly art history even in Japan, and certainly not in the West. And I have to say that encounter with the founder of the Neo-Dada organizers, such an important group for the post-war Japanese avant-garde, was the sort of incentive to my continued research. And many of the artists, Arakawa, Yayoi Kusama, Onkawara, Shigeko Kubota, and of course Namjoon Paik, born in Korea but raised in schooled in Japan and very active in the Japanese avant-garde as well as the European and New York avant-garde, were active in living in New York for periods of time, or certainly in many of them still in the 1980s when I was working there. So it all began right outside my doorstep.
And Britta, your story.
Well, I came into contemporary Chinese art through a combination of intellectual background plus curiosity and stubbornness, I would say. I have a doctoral degree in Chinese art history, and my subject was a 19th century artist, Ren Xiong. When I did my doctoral dissertation, the 19th century was considered exceedingly modern for the subject of intellectual inquiry on that level. At that time, textbooks or survey books on Asian art stopped either at 1800, or if they were sort of forward-looking and modern, they went up to 1900. But I was fortunate to have as my professor Michael Sullivan, who is a senior figure in the field and who in his youth lived in China and was good friends with all the artists of the 30s and 40s. So he encouraged me when I became curious to go to China and find out what I could about contemporary art.
And when was that?
So I went for the first time in 1985. Uh-huh. Some of my professors told me I was completely crazy. It was a waste of time. There was no such thing as contemporary Chinese art. Mm. And actually, it was very difficult to find anything out when I went there. But I persisted. I sort of plugged away at it. And then it's interesting. It sounds like it's a little bit like Alexandra's experience. Through working on an exhibition for one particular artist, I then entered a wider world. I was very fortunate to write the catalog for Xu Bing's first exhibition, solo exhibition outside of Asia. That was in 1990, when people really didn't know anything about contemporary Chinese art in this country. And that exhibition sort of launched both Xu Bing's and my career. He's now extremely famous, and I'm very busy now that people are actually becoming interested in contemporary Chinese art. And then through Xu Bing, I met a lot of other artists and then started going to China very frequently, so that now over the course of 20 years and going there several times a year, I've become very familiar with the situation there.
Yeah. Now, for the two of you, you've mentioned, well, Alexandra mentioned many artists, but she started off with, and correct me if I'm incorrect here, Yoshio Shinoharu, a Japanese artist in New York City, and then Britta talking about Zhu Bing. When you first saw the work of these two artists, did you experience the shock of the new? My question here is, do art scholars experience what we do so often when we go into a gallery or a museum?
I'll start at that.
Okay.
Not really. I think one of the kind of misconceptions about contemporary Asian art, there are many, is that we are not going to understand it. That is often true, but not for the reason that we generally think. Walking into Shinohara's studio, or later when I did the exhibition of Yayoi Kusama, which, like Britta's exhibition of Zhu Bing, very much launched Kusama's reappraisal in the international art world, it looks familiar. I mean, these artists are working in a modernist language. They have grown up, certainly in Japan, with a very deep and sophisticated intellectual and cultural modernist and even avant-garde philosophy that they and practice in art world. It might be very marginalized, and certainly in the pre-war and immediate post-war period, it was very much marginalized, but these artists struggled to find their place within those worlds. So, no, the product looks, Kusama's product looks, you know, vaguely at first, perhaps like minimalism, or Shinohara's work looks vaguely like, you know, a kind of narrative pop art. It's only, I mean, and many modern curators, contemporary curators, make the mistake of stopping there and making the decision that either the work is derivative of, for example, those two movements and therefore not worth pursuing, or it is pretty good examples of international modernism or pop art and minimalism or pop art, let's include them. That's the mistake. It's only upon research and interviewing and extensive reading of what was going on at the time of this work's making, or the time of the artist's coming of age, that it becomes unknown, an understanding of the artist's context, intellectual, political, historic, as you said. It's only then that we enter territory that has not been charted.
Hmm. Britta, you have a comment?
Yes. You asked first if when we see some works of art, if we're surprised or astonished at them. And I would say only to the extent that I would be by any extremely inventive or imaginative artist who has created something that I would never have dreamed of. It's nothing in their national background is contributing to that. It's just their creative power and originality of vision as an artist that does that. But actually, I think a little bit of what you're getting at is how is our personal cultural background, does that stand as a barrier to understanding contemporary mm-hmm. Asian art? And I have a little story that reflects my feeling about this. Actually, I have two sides of the feeling. I think that, of course, the more knowledge you have, the better you can understand what is going on. But I don't think there's anything inherent in one's background that's going to be a barrier to that. I was once at a symposium in Chengdu where it was mostly Chinese curators and critics participating, and there were only maybe three foreigners. One of the leading curators in China stood up and, kind of apropos of nothing, said, "Foreigners can't understand contemporary Chinese art," which sort of blew me away. And I started thinking, well, you know, is there any reason to really think that Chinese people can understand contemporary Chinese art? If you're going to say a person has to have a particular background to understand art created by a person of that background, then it becomes very limiting. You might say that only a person from the province of Sichuan can understand art by a person from that province. And if it's by a woman, maybe you have to be a woman to understand it. And if it's a 20-year-old, maybe you have to be a 20. You know, you narrow it down till you get to the point where only the artist would be able to understand it. And then often artists don't always really understand what they're doing. So anyway, it's very limiting to narrow things down in that way. And I think we all have to understand that we bring our backgrounds, our point of view to any art that we look at. And as long as we're aware of what we're bringing to this work of art, and as long as we're willing to try and understand what the artist is doing, then it should just be a good experience.
Yeah, and also it seems to me that the art ultimately is going to stand on its own away from the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And also that contexts change. There can be shifts in what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the piece or the installation can look very different and have a different meaning, if you will, mm-hmm. down the line.
That's absolutely true, and especially with the artist Xu Bing, with whom I've worked quite a bit, we've sort of found that if you exhibit his works in different places or different times, the same thing can have a very different meaning to the audience. And if the artist is okay with that, then that just gloms on to the work of art as it passes through time and space.
Yeah, I think that would please the artist.
Mm-hmm.
Alexandra?
Well, I don't know if I entirely agree. I actually have very much campaigned for understanding an artist's background and understanding, again, the context
mm-hmm.
that contributed to that artist's education and to the really the meaning of that work of art. And I think a work of art, yes, the meaning can change over time, but as art historians, that's not always our focus, especially as art historians looking at the very recent past. I think our job is to identify and articulate and interpret as best we possibly can the original intent of the creation of that work of art. And for an example, I want to speak about the exhibition that I recently worked on with the artist Takashi Murakami, who, of course, is extremely well known in this country, the exhibition Little Boy, the mm-hmm. Arts of Japan's Exploding Subculture that we presented at Japan Society in the summer of 2000, spring and summer 2005. Takashi Murakami has been over the last 5 years or so probably the artist who has commanded the highest prices in the international market for his paintings and sculpture. His work has been collected widely by collectors who also collect Jeff Koons, who also collect other examples of contemporary sort of international sort of what's called neo-pop. Most of the younger people who were enormous fans of Takashi Murakami's and by extension Japanese contemporary anime culture and some of the fashion trends that were associated with that basically thought that the general sort of discourse, I mean street discourse, even if someone's paying up to $600,000 for a painting, the general discourse was that this work was kind of funny and cute and amusing. And that is entirely not the case. What Takashi Murakami proved so eloquently in the exhibition and in the very extensive catalog that we published in conjunction with the show was that this was an extremely dark interpretation and reaction to the amnesia of war in post-war Japan, how cartoons were the only method in post-war Japanese popular culture to express the response to defeat, to express the response to the horror of the atomic bomb, to suppress Japan's own responsibility for the atrocities committed in the Pacific War that led to the American invasion. There was a whole, he presented this whole thesis, how this kind of culture of cute is actually a very perverse, arrested development. That's the outcome of Japan's relationship to America in the post-war period. That was a very infantilized relationship. And because official war discourse was completely suppressed for several reasons we won't go into now, cartoons, subculture, toys, warrior robotics, and many of the inventions and innovations that became so popular have become so popular abroad within the world of Japanese anime. We're all had very much a violent core, a violent significance that was central to their creation and central to the significance that they held within their own subculture. And this had been entirely lost on the American public, who had rapidly been acquiring this work and contributing to this, you know, celebrity status of Takashi Murakami with very little understanding of what this actually meant in the context of post-war Japan, which Americans remain extremely ignorant of, and of even the America's own role in many of the myths that the Japanese have suffered under in the amnesia. So I really believe in scholarship and in understanding, delving into all kinds of related areas to the moment of art making, including literature, including subculture, including popular culture, if that's appropriate. That's where I stand.
Yeah, and I think maybe we should mention that Little Boy was the code name for the bomb.
Exactly.
That was dropped first.
Little Boy was the code name for the bomb that dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. But it had this, you know, extraordinarily brilliant double entendre in the context of the show, because it's also, the show was filled with images of cartoonish figures mm-hmm. of children with these oversized heads and these overscaled eyes and the sexuality of kind of, you know, prepubescent Lolita complex and all the kind of violence of a 12-year-old boy that's kind of manifest and packed into the images, both in popular culture and also subsequently as it kind of eked out into the work of Takashi Murakami, Yoshitomo Nara, and others of Japan's so-called neo-pop movement.
Yeah. Britta Erickson, maybe you would talk about some more about Zhu Bing and his book From the Sky, because that also is a response to suppression. Yes?
That's not necessarily
okay.
the case. He, as he describes it, when he was a young artist just finishing up at the Art Academy in like around 1987 or so, well, he was a young teacher there. And at that time, China had been closed off from the rest of the world during the Cultural Revolution, which went from 1966 to 1976. And then after the death of Mao in 1976, things gradually started loosening up so that information began to come into China from the West, information about art movements outside of China, as well as philosophical texts. So that as these things poured into China and became translated, people, intellectuals, spent all their time reading these new sources, and had spent there were many, many seminars and meetings and a lot of serious discourse around these new ideas. But Zhu Bing says that he became very tired of all of this after a while. It was just too much text. And going along with his experience of text during the Cultural Revolution, which was that it was all propaganda, the written word began to have kind of very little meaning to him. It was a sign, a graph, but the meaning was not reliable. So he had the idea of designing things that looked like Chinese characters but actually were not. So he shut himself away, figuratively, not literally, but he spent over a year designing Chinese characters that were not genuine, but that looked genuine. And he came up in the end with 1,200 that he thought were pretty good, and had books printed from these and bound to look like traditional classic texts. And then he displayed these in exhibitions in 1988 and 1999, both as a sea of books spread on the floor and of scrolls of this same text hanging from the ceiling. And people were just overwhelmed by it. They thought it meant all kinds of things. They thought it was a complete rejection of Chinese culture. They thought it looked funereal. Some people really could not believe that he had spent all this time to make what was, on the surface at least, something meaningless. And he was given a lot of grief. There were many seminars held about this work of art because people were so fascinated by it and thought it represented a new direction and new hope for the Chinese contemporary art scene. But after a while, officials became upset about it, and friends of his who would organize seminars on it would get in trouble also. It was very hot for him for a while, and in the end he decided it would be more comfortable or a better situation for creativity overseas. And that's how he ended up moving to the United States.
Okay. So then Book from the Sky was conceived prior to Tiananmen Square. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So that's my problem, isn't it, with history?
Well, many people in this country, actually, that's the problem with having a little bit of knowledge. Whatever knowledge you have, you want to use. And I'm not criticizing you. This is just general. You know, if you have a screwdriver and you see a nail, you want to use the screwdriver to get the nail out instead of going to get a hammer. A little bit of knowledge can be dangerous. And actually, this has, I think, a broader implication for looking at contemporary Asian art outside of Asia, especially in this country where many people may be familiar, as you mentioned at the beginning of this session, who may be familiar with early Asian art. And if you invest a lot of time in learning about this, or you're very happy to know about this, then of course you want to apply that knowledge when you're looking at contemporary art. And it may be relevant, or then again, it may not.
Yeah. Well, the two of you, what do you do as curators to help those of us who are entering a gallery with screwdrivers rather than the appropriate tool? How do you try and reach us and say, put down the screwdriver, come with me?
Well, I believe in providing a lot of information for people in a catalog. Or if the catalog, but there's not going to be a catalog, then in wall labels. I think you have to give people the opportunity to acquire the knowledge to understand something properly. Otherwise, unless a work of art is something you can just look at and appreciate without that background knowledge, you're sort of doing a disservice both to the audience and the artist to display it without a proper introduction.
I would agree with Britta that certainly in the experience of the exhibition, I very much believe in words. Not didactic words, not a lot of words, but words that lead to ideas, that express ideas, and ideas that lead to an opening of the eyes and the minds of the public who you have invited in. I also very much believe in a catalog to serve as a document of the exhibition, and more importantly as an opportunity to introduce new scholarship, commission and publish new scholarship and research. And I also very much believe in presenting an exhibition that one has, the museum presents a wide number of, varied number of public programs in conjunction with the show, whether that be a film series of related material, performances of related material, lectures, discussions with the artists if they are indeed still around and alive and able to conduct live interviews, sort of what we used to call inside the studio events with artists, for a curator or critic to kind of get into the mind and let the audience experience the immediacy and the brilliance of the artist and how he or she interprets the meaning of their work. I think a show also, you know, is has to be like theater. I mean, you can have important work, but it can, if it's in a badly curated, badly thought out exhibition, it's not going to achieve what you want it to achieve. It's exhibition needs, like theater, I always say, a beginning, middle, and end. It needs a couple of protagonists. It has to make you happy. It has to make you sad. You have usually an hour of somebody's time to change their ideas about the world, to go away with at least a couple of ideas. Your show might be presenting many, but what you hope is that someone will take away and keep and ponder and bring with them to other experiences of art and culture a few. So I think that the clarity for a curator to have just very rigorous clarity and very big ideas in setting out to present the material, I think that helps convey what we want to convey in really what is essentially an educational process, an educational experience.
Art historians Alexandra Monroe and Britta Erickson are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. They will be in Champaign-Urbana later this week to participate in the symposium Making a Scene, Contemporary East Asian Art in the U.S. For more information, you may contact the Center for East Asian and Pacific Studies at the University of Illinois and or the Krannert Art Museum. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question or comment. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Ask for a definition of contemporary East Asian art. How do you respond? Britta, you want to take that up? It's a big question, I know.
You know, it's hard to pin down a certain date when you would say contemporary begins. Different institutions have come up with hardened dates. But for me, I think with Chinese art, it starts maybe in the 80s when sort of revolution in thinking about art happened in China. And then the other issue is with not just with Chinese art, but with Asian art, is who do you include as a contemporary Asian artist?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have to have been born in Asia? Can they be Asian but born overseas? If they were born in China but moved to the United States when they were, 15, are they a Chinese artist? You know, is there some age where you're going to have there be a cutoff? It's something that is really emotionally fraught for some of the people in the Asian art world, but not something that you can really pin down.
Alexandra?
I would agree with Britta. There are all those questions that we haven't answered yet, and that's part of the excitement for, I think, both of us working in it, in really an emerging field both within the academy and within the museum world. I think there's also the question that Britta's referring to, which is how do we define Asian American artists? are they Americans or are they Asians? And I would answer both. I'm working on a show that will include, that's really the focus is American art, the influence of Asian ideas on American art. But certainly Yoko Ono, Nam June Paik, Kusama are central to that story as Asian-born artists who were working in the American avant-garde. But I have also included those three artists in an exhibition of a survey of the post-war Japanese avant-garde because they were also active there in those areas in Tokyo. Or their work may have been covered in the Japanese art magazines as Kusama's was and exerted enormous influence even though her most important work was not done in Japan. She was in the United States living for 15 years during the time of her great influence. I think these are complex and interesting questions. I think they also change from decade to decade. So many Asian artists who came over in the 50s and 60s for political reasons, for economic reasons, did not travel back to their country of origin for a decade at a time. Nowadays, many artists, including I think some of the artists that Britta is working with, certainly an artist like Takashi Murakami or Mariko Mori, have studios in both Japan and the United States and sort of have a dual artistic citizenship, certainly if not a global one.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, the titles of your Alexandra, your upcoming exhibition, Contemplating the East, Asian Ideas and Modern American Art, and Britta's exhibition that opened today, On the Edge, Contemporary Chinese Artists Encounter the West. Both of these exhibitions suggest a conversation.
I think there is a conversation. There's always a conversation, Britta, I'm sure you would agree. Yeah. I mean, all art comes from art. All great thought comes from great thought. And we're dealing with a period, this is not, you know, the 9th century. And by the way, even the 9th century, as we know, was, you know, there was always cross currents. There's always an exchange of ideas. But in dealing with the modern and contemporary, however you choose to periodize those. Even in China during the Cultural Revolution, you had artists who were ransacking libraries that had been confiscated by the 14-year-old Red Guards, and they were reading about Picasso and Dadaism at a time when you would have been thrown in jail officially had you mentioned the names of those degenerate artists or degenerate movements. Mm-hmm. There is always an exchange of ideas, and certainly in Japan, with the exception of about a 3-year period at the height of World War II and imperialist and totalitarian suppression, you had artists traveling from Japan to the Dadaist centers of Berlin and Zurich, and later America, certainly Paris and London. And let's not forget, American artists and European artists were traveling to Asia also, we know, in droves from the late 19th century. There are international art magazines. There are international shows that gain immense currency and frequency in the post-war period. You have at the heart of modernism itself and at the heart certainly of contemporary sort of postmodernism, a universalism, a utopianism, or more recently, a globalism. Artists don't want to be local. They are interested in conversation of the ideas that both divide and unite people living at the edge of consciousness in a contemporary society.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I'd like to add to that in this field for a long time, people in the West for centuries looked at the East as something exotic, and this exoticism has carried forward through the 20th century, and it still exists, but it is something that we need to find ways to get away from, and it's interesting to actually try looking a little bit at the West from the point of view of the East, because that really drives home the point that we have to be careful about recognizing what our point of view is, and considering the fact that both everybody's looking at everybody, and it can certainly be very useful to look at another culture, because it can bring home to you what your culture is all about.
Right.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, we've focused primarily on Japan and China, and I think we should say something about Korea. What would you like to say about Korea's contemporary artists and their art?
I'll start on that, because I've done a bit of work. I know Britt is very interested as well. I think we all would agree that although stylistically, art from contemporary China, Japan, Korea might look similar. Perhaps we have artists who are working in installation art or video art or large scale photography. Stylistically, there might be connections. But again, for artists who come out of either one of those countries, I think the issues are very distinct. China, perhaps the most distinct of all, because of the situation of the Cultural Revolution and so many of the artists who are coming of, you know, contemporary Chinese artists were raised during that period and very much shaped by that. Korean art, I think, is gradually gaining more international recognition. Certainly in Japan, over the last 20, 25 years, there have been a number of Korean artists who are showing regularly in the Japanese galleries and who have, in a sense, been first discovered by Japanese critics and the art world and museum world there. I think it's very exciting what is developing in Korea. You have some artists working in a very political mode. You have other artists working in a more, you know, craft mode. The contemporary Korean ceramics are fantastic. And you have artists like Kim Suk-ja working in video, in one of the most lyrical video artists working today anywhere in the world. So I certainly, although it was perhaps Americans are so ignorant about Korea, I think generally we've known first about Japan, we know less about contemporary China, we're becoming forced to be crash course learners, but we probably know least of all about Korea, and mm-hmm. I hope that more and more artists will be introduced and contemporary exhibitions dealing with Korean art will travel to alert us to the amazing innovation and excitement that's going on there.
And I think that people in America have become very aware of Japanese art and Chinese art because the economic situation has forced them to take a look at these countries. In the 80s, Japan was very powerful economically, and now everybody's wondering what China will do. Korea hasn't been in a situation to exert that much influence on the imagination of Americans. But I think the art there's producing some wonderful things, and I think it's frustrating to people that they're not getting the kind of attention that the Japanese and Chinese artists are getting.
Hmm. A minute left here. Anything you'd like to add? Anything you'd like to sum up with this afternoon? Alexandra?
Well, I want to thank you very much for this opportunity, and I think art is a form of diplomacy and a form of enlightenment and education, and the more we see and look and try to reach out to understand the work of another country or of other people who are living right here in our own midst, the better place the world might be.
Mm. Britta?
Well, and I agree, and I think certainly you should go look. The more you look, the more you'll appreciate it, and certainly if you put a little effort into it, you can learn a great deal.
Mm. It's been my pleasure to talk with the two of you. It's something I've always thought would be wonderful to do, is to have a long conversation with a curator about the art and craft of curating an exhibition, because we only see your work in the gallery, in the museum, and in the catalog. And we so rarely get to see you. You're hidden for most of us. So it's been a great pleasure to talk with the two of you.
Thank you.
Britta Erickson and Alexandra Monroe have been our guests this afternoon in this portion of the program. They are art historians and curators. They will be in Champaign-Urbana later this week to participate in the symposium Making a Scene, Contemporary East Asian Art in the U.S. It's open to the public. It begins February 17th, Friday, and runs through Saturday, the 18th. For more information, you can contact the Center for East Asian and Pacific Studies at the University of Illinois or the Cranston Art Museum. And let me mention that Britta has an exhibition opening today at the Davis Museum at Wellesley College, On the Edge, Contemporary Chinese Artists Encounter the West. It will travel to the Indianapolis Museum of Art in July. And Alexandra Monroe, a newly appointed senior curator of Asian art at the Guggenheim Museum in New York City, is planning an exhibition there titled Contemplating the East, Asian Ideas and Modern American Art.